Oh, it's time for another live show. It's 1900 UTC, and that means it's time for That's News to Me. I'm your host, DJ Marcus. Let's see what's happening in the world today. Oh boy, oh boy. So, greetings. Today is July 22nd, and it is 1900 UTC. Greetings, DCTRUD in com. I don't know how to pronounce it, but welcome. So, today, I've got way too many stories, and I've found that what's interesting, it's kind of fun anyway, is when the news cycle's going, what we've got is we get kind of a focus, or there's certain stories that grab attention, and then when the attention breaks, suddenly the stories get scattered again until everyone finds something to hone in on again. So today is going to be a little bit scattered. Howdy to X1 Income. Welcome, welcome. So first few stories I have are from the site I was talking about yesterday called allsides.com. And so this is, hopefully these are stories trying to be a little more news oriented. So first up, there's some tension with the US and China, if you weren't aware of that. And so friction between the US and China is ratcheted up this week as China expands naval operations. U.S. defense officials have moved to implement countermeasures. The U.S. ordered China to close its Houston consulate over national security fears after two Chinese hackers were charged with allegedly trying to steal COVID-19 coronavirus vaccine data. And 11 Chinese companies have been sanctioned over purported human rights abuses against Uyghur Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. The tension has been a focus of media coverage on all sides of the political spectrum, with voices from both left and right criticizing China for various reasons. Right-rated outlets and voices focused more on the alleged genocide taking place, where Uyghurs are reportedly in political re-education programs, which are being compared to, like, concentration camps. And then from the center, we've got people talking about the military angle. So China launched its military buildup in the 90s, keep the United States at bay in any conflict by making the waters off the Chinese coast a death trap. Now China's People's Liberation Army is preparing to challenge American power further afield. China's shipyards have launched the PLA Navy's first two Type 075 amphibious assault ships, which will form the spearhead of an expeditionary force to play a role similar to that of the U.S. Marine Corps. So that's what Reuters is saying about all this. And then on the right, you know, we'd mention them. And then, so China is in the news. So that's kind of a roundup. We've got kind of a spectrum. Some of the local news I saw about this was there were some people at the consulate, like, burning papers out in the, they had a helicopter flying over, and it was like, these guys from the consulate were, like, out in the courtyard burning a whole bunch of documents. So it kind of just stirred up a bunch of anxiety. So that's something. A few quick headlines, just because I thought this was cool. Twitter banned 7,000 QAnon accounts and limited 150,000 others as part of a broad crackdown. And so the company classifies QAnon as coordinated harmful activity in part because of its rise in harassment targeting high-profile critics of the president. So that's something Twitter is trying to do. So this is, I feel like, well, this is a national story. Let's jump to a better international story real quick. I have recently started playing with tabs. It is news to me. Greetings, SMJ, in the comm. So let's talk about some more international news. Sorry. So this comes out of Counterpunch, counterpunch.org, and this is news coming out of Libya. So Ahmed, who lives in Tripoli, Libya, texts me. The author is named Vijay Prashad. So Ahmed, who lives in Tripoli, Libya, texts me that the city is quieter than before. The army of General Khalifa Haftar, who controls large parts of eastern Libya, has withdrawn from the southern part of the capital and is now... has withdrawn from the southern part of the capital, is now holding fast in the city of Sirte and at the air base of Jufra. Most of Libya's population lives along the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea, which is where the cities of Tripoli, Sirte, Benghazi, and Tobruk are located. So, let's see if we can get an actual bit, a small one. Of course, oil is a major part of the equation. Libya has at least 46 billion barrels of sweet crude oil. This oil is highly valued for Europe because of the low cost to extract and transport it. Countries like the UAE, which are pushing the embargo of Libyan oil, benefit from the withdrawal of Libyan, Iranian, and Venezuelan oil from already suppressed world oil markets. Libya's National Oil Corporation has stopped oil exports since January from about 1.10 million barrels per day. Libyan oil production fell to nearly 70,000 barrels per day. Neither Haftar nor the government of National Accord in Tripoli can agree on the export of oil from the country. And the UN Secretary General has surrendered to reality. In his recent statement on Libya, he listed a series of de-escalation efforts, including the creation of a possible demilitarized zone. Neither Ahmad nor Rita would like their country to be partitioned, its oil then siphoned off to Europe, and its wealth stolen by oligarchs. So, time is not on Libya's side. Neither side can help out. I don't know what 3B2 is. And tonight at 0200, we've got a TED Talk by Jazzmaz. So tune in, because as always, you're listening to...
Anon Radio is your non-commercial, non-profit, member-supported underground radio station.
Powered by the SDF Public Access Unix System.
So here's one other international story that's kind of cool. Or I don't want to say cool. They're all weird, but I didn't see a bunch of them. This falls into COVID-19 territory. So COVID-19 infections are skyrocketing in South Africa. Now, fifth in the world for coronavirus cases, with an already fragile hospital system. I really think it's our inequality reckoning moment, says Fatima Hassan, a human rights lawyer with the Health Justice Initiative. All of the fault lines of South Africa's post-apartheid democracy and its inequality and its violence is actually coming to the fore. So they have a transcript of an interview, if you want to read it. But the basic gist of it was... I'll just read the part of her quote here. What is important, and I should point out, is that unlike HIV/AIDS, our government's initial response, and up until today, has been rooted in science and evidence. But that science and evidence is a first world science and evidence. It's designed for countries where people can stay at home and can work from home, where they have secure employment. It's designed for countries where there's sufficient socioeconomic rights, protections, and benefits if you're unable to go to work. It's designed for countries that get socially distanced, where you don't have thousands of informal settlements that are densely populated. It's designed for countries where there's proper sanitation, where there's running water for every single person in the country, and where there's secure food supplies. So like I said earlier, I think the fault lines of inequality in South Africa is coming to the fore. The crisis of our health system, which as you'll recall because of apartheid is a dualized healthcare system. It's basically based on race and class, where the rich can afford really high-quality private health care and the poor have to rely on high-quality but inconsistent access to health care services. These are provinces we call the neglected provinces, where the health systems have basically collapsed, where the national government is probably going to have to intervene and step in to take over the running of those health departments. So, yeah, so it's pretty sad, but that is the truth. A lot of something that that bugs me is that the people who are in power look at everything from their perspective and don't seem to consider the other perspectives. And so now you have, like this is pointing out, you know, you have people that are totally you know, if everyone had running water and could work from home and didn't have to leave the house, that would be a great approach. Similarly, in the U.S., Detroit doesn't have, a lot of citizens don't have running water there, and they don't have good jobs. You know, they don't have work from home jobs. So those people are SOL. They're having to go out. They're having to get sick. And they're also all at higher risks. So it's just, there's lots of pain out there for this. So, but, you know, it's not always all bad news, but there's a lot of weird and unhappy things going on all the time. And so these are the international stories that were bugging me. So let's go ahead here. And there's a CD or a record I got called Instant Karma. It was from Amnesty's International Campaign to Save Darfur a few years ago now. But anyway, I wanted to play a song called Power to the People by the Black Eyed Peas. And just let me know in calm if it's too loud.
Listening to Anon Radio, powered by SDF Public Access Unix System.
All right, welcome back. So let's talk about some national news. There's so much going on right now that it's pretty wild. There's just a bunch of stuff. So I'll try to not dwell too long. One of the first things to mention is that NASA, because space is cool and gender equality is cool. But basically, NASA's, this is from All Sides. Well, it's from the Christian Science Monitor, but I'm reading it off of All Sides. NASA's spacesuits have a gender problem, and these women, they're fixing it. It was going to be a historic moment last spring. For the first time, an entirely female team of astronauts was to embark on a spacewalk. But just days before Anne McLean and Christina Koch were to venture outside the International Space Station, NASA swapped Miss McLean for a man. They'd realized there weren't two spacesuits ready that would work for both women. That reversal drew scorn. Instead of a moment to celebrate, shucks, why did I lose my place? To celebrate the agency's progress toward gender equality, it seemed to expose how much work remained in supporting female astronauts. So, the alteration, in the 60s, the spacesuits were made custom-made for individual astronauts. In the 70s, agency's priorities shifted, more astronauts flew, so NASA opted for spacewalking suits, officially called extravehicular mobility units, that could be used by multiple astronauts to save money and time. The suits are modular, with separate pieces for arms, legs, and torsos. Women, the thinking went, could fit into the same sizes made for smaller men. That plan might have worked acceptably, but later budget cuts led to NASA slashing some of the sizes, leaving only medium and larges. So, what about that? How crazy. NASA doesn't have enough money to make all the sizes, even make the regular interchangeable sizes. So, after experiencing microgravity, she realized she needed a different torso size, and so there is no universal suit, is basically the gist. In October 2019, two women had come up for the spacing job once again, and astronauts Miss Koch and Jessica Mayer performed the first all-female spacewalk. So, yeah, the U.S. leading the way in saying but not doing. In the U.S. saying but not doing, that's a great segue, because the U.S. is doing a lot of unsavory things around the world, and in the U.S. even. So this comes from, so this is another one of those All Sides kind of like aggregates that's kind of hopefully giving us a little better kind of generic view of what's going on. Let's see. Oh, sorry. You're going to hear me type in here. So astronauts, just to throw this out, the minimum required height is 4'10.5", and the maximum height was 6'4". That was the only requirement. In the past, or at least whenever they first started the astronaut program. But the restrictions will now be based on weight and sitting height. But they don't list it, so you'll have to figure that on your own. Sorry, I was answering a question in comm. Also, shout out to Exiled. I don't know if I gave a shout out. Thanks for everyone who tuned in today. So, federal agents, ruined my segue, I'm sorry. Federal agents have been dispatched to Portland. So here's the quick facts. During the week of July 15th, camouflaged federal agents began arresting protesters in Portland off the streets, taking them in unmarked vans. Customs and Border Protection, the federal agency tasked with securing the border, claimed responsibility for many of the arrests. Federal agents also shot tear gas at protesters following attempts to break into federal courthouse. The protests in Portland have been ongoing since the murder of George Floyd in late May and have escalated in recent weeks. The CBP said it acted under the Department of Homeland Security's Protecting American Communities Task Force Pact, which began addressing civil unrest in July following an executive order. While some local officials have asked DHS to remove its agents, Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf stated that he did not need invitations by the state, state mayors, or state governors to do our job. President Trump has since suggested sending federal agents to additional cities with ongoing protests. So depending on where you go, it depends. So we have camouflaged federal agents descend on Portland. Trump's DHS is out of control. The border war in Portland. Portland protests. Democratic authorities tacitly endorse violent riots. And then Portland riots. It is Trump's constitutional duty to enforce federal law, and he should. So as you can see, there's a wide spectrum of interpretation. But I think we can all agree that they definitely shouldn't be talking about preemptively arresting people. And that's something that I'm too agitated about, so I'm not going to talk about it. We're going to play a song. Wait, I just read that one story. Hold on. Let's read one more story. And then, I'm just all over the place. I'm anxious about stuff going on at work. Here we go. This is the related one I wanted to share. Philly DA, this is from In These Times, and Philadelphia's DA Larry Krasner says he's ready to charge invading federal agents with crimes. When unidentifiable federal agents began snatching protests off the street in Portland, people got nervous. When Trump said earlier this week that he wanted to roll out the same strategy to Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and other cities, we got more nervous still. The elected officials in most of these cities urged the feds to stay away. In Philadelphia, District Attorney Larry Krasner took the extra step of issuing a statement threatening to prosecute them, saying, "Anyone, including federal law enforcement, who unlawfully assaults and kidnaps people will face criminal charges from my office." Such brash obstinacy was very much in character for Krasner, who spent his career as a left-wing defense lawyer before getting elected DA in 2017 as a progressive reformer on a platform of ending mass incarceration. He sued the Philadelphia Police Department at least 75 times before being elected DA. So, there's an interview, if you want to read that, on In These Times. Philadelphia is also famous for having dropped a bomb from an airplane on the move on a protest house where they thought somebody was. So they killed a bunch of people, like 15 people there. One of the first civil rights leaders is from there, and he was murdered by the police. In like the 1800s, it's like the late 1800s, and yeah, just in general, Philadelphia has a rich history of violent racism, and so it's kind of cool that hopefully protesters will be protected. All right, so let's jump into a song, and then we'll do one other story. So, off of Instant Karma, we're going to go ahead. We're not going to play that. Ugh. Sorry, I almost played a Green Day song. I double-clicked the wrong line. I was like, uh-oh. This song is going to be called Imagine, and it's by Willie Nelson.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, and above us on the sky. Imagine all. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion too.
This song was originally written by John Lennon in 1971. Best-selling single of his solo career.
And you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. the world will live as one. Possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. And imagine all the people sharing. The only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
All righty. At the request from Calm, we've got just about 3 minutes left, but we're going to do a couple of quick feel-good stories. I got two of them. One, Shaq pulled over to help a Florida woman after her car crashed. Shaq is no stranger to being featured in headlines, but it's not just because of his legendary sports career. It's also regularly praised for having a heart of gold. In addition to being hailed for his charity work and random acts of kindness, Shaq was lauded by law enforcement on Facebook after he stopped to help a woman who was in a car accident last week. Shaq pulled off I-75 when he saw the woman's tire blow out. After making sure that she was okay and following the collision, he waited with her until law enforcement arrived. So, way to go, Shaq. Shaq attack. And then, this next one is pretty cool. And these are coming from the goodnewsnetwork.org, which is where I go to find good news whenever I'm looking for a happy story and I'm getting too sad or angry. So, when you think of Harvard Law, a few things probably come to mind. Wealth, prestige, distinguished libraries, maybe sweater vests. You likely wouldn't conjure a picture of a sanitation worker getting up at 4 a.m. to clean dumpsters and sort trash before school. But then you don't know Rehan Staten, or Staden. While getting into Harvard Law School is no easy feat for just about anyone, Rehan, whose single-parent family was poor, truly had his work cut out for him. And he doesn't take all the credit either. He gives most of it to the people around him. And he doesn't take all the credit. He gives most around. The 24-year-old college student told Today, after going through everything that we did as a family, I just felt that we got into Harvard, and like, I just can't even explain it. It was we. The community around him made all the difference, he says. Rehan admits he was hungry for more after living through years of family struggles and poverty. While growing up in Bowie, Maryland, his mother abandoned the family and moved out of the country when he was 8 years old. However, that was also when he began learning the value of hard work. So, that's pretty cool. So, let's see if we can get to... Here we go. While most people heading to Harvard Law have the grades, the financial support, and maybe the sweater vest, Rehan just had his own painful story to stand on. The same story that makes him an inspiration. So, way to go, Rehan. Congratulations. And also, just to go ahead and say... Boom, we got to be sure and call out oppression. There's a lot of racial injustice going on. So please be sure you vote and research people before you vote. It's time for DGC. I'm so excited.
Well,
Girlfriend
that
Vietnam.
Sounds means that our time's come to an end. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow.
DJ Marcus.
Weekday, Monday through Friday. Before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.